Welcome back to the Scottish Curling Podcast, the show where we sweep through the stories, the strategy and the spirit of Scottish curling, past and present. I'm your host Peter Joyce and this is episode 2. Trust me, it gets no bigger than this. Our guest is a true legend of the rink, a man whose name is stitched into the very fabric of Scottish curling. All the way from the Northwest Castle Hotel, he went to the top of the podium at the World Championships. Born and bred in Stranraer, where Europe's first indoor curling rink gave him ice to dream on all year round, Hammy McMillan Sr. honed his craft to become one of Scotland's most decorated skips and one of its great curling storytellers too. He's a six-time Scottish men's champion, a European gold medalist, and of course, the man who led Scotland to that unforgettable World Championship win in St John, New Brunswick, back in 1999, beating Canada's Jeff Stoughton in an extra end in his own backyard. We talk Olympic highs and lows, starting back in Calgary in 86, to captaining Team GB at Salt Lake City in 2002, to mentoring the next generation. Hammy's career is a masterclass in grit, strategy and love for the game. And if that legacy needed another chapter, his son, Hammy McMillan Jr., has more than obliged, carrying the McMillan name into a new golden era with Team Mivet. So grab yourself a cup of tea, get comfy and join us as we chat about Hammy's early days in Stranraer, the big wins, the heartbreaks, and what it means to see the next generation fearlessly taking Scottish curling to new heights. This is a story about family, community, and the roaring game we all love, with one of its true Scottish icons. Here's Hammy McMillan Sr., right here on the Scottish Curling Podcast. Enjoy.
So everyone, welcome. What a real pleasure it is to be here at the Craig and Elder Hotel in Stranraer with Hammy McMillan. And I'm going to ask you, what's the right suffix to that? Is it Hammy McMillan the second? Hammy McMillan Senior? Because obviously you've got a huge curling family, a lot of history in the family through curling here in Stranraer as well. So how do you go? Is it Hammy McMillan Senior or is it something else?
I think now I'm senior. my father was senior. He was actually the second Hamilton. Uh-huh. In direct line, I was the third. Hamilton's now the fourth.
Wow!
So it's a name that stuck. It's there, and everybody sort of knows it. It's Hammy, but generally speaking, nowadays it's Hamilton.
Aye.
More than anything else, because everyone's booked. Uh-huh. Is now if you go travel, everyone else it's got to be your full name and
right.
Everyone.
So Sunday name's back in vogue then.
Sunday name's back in.
Right. And let's talk about your family growing up. What was curling for you as a young boy, obviously with the family that you had and still have now? How did you get into the game? Was it just family brought you along the rink and said, that's what you do, son?
No. my father built a nice rink.
Right.
And I think we were probably about 7 or 8 years old at the time. So it became part and parcel of life. And at that time, we were probably living next door to the ice rink. Uh-huh. So we spent, as soon as the ice rink was open, come October time, any spare time we had, we'd be flying up the ice, jumping on stones, and not so much playing at that age. And that's really what we did. Every single spare minute we had, or spare ice, there would be a game, either one-on-one or two-on-two. Uh-huh. How many boys that were there turned around? And I'm still playing my one or two of them in the seniors to this day, you know, 50-odd years later.
So, yeah, Peter and I have seen you in action at the seniors. We might come back to that later on in the interview. So, we're looking at your curling CV. When did you first start to become prominent in the Scottish scene? Obviously, you've got, you know, 7 Scottish championships to your name. And so, what was the first team that you were a part of that you said, right, this is going to be the thing?
We went through juniors, and probably in our junior days, we had teams that, I think way back in, I was at school in Edinburgh at Merkerson Castle, and we qualified out of Edinburgh to go to the national junior finals. And at that time, Andrew McQueeston and his Stranraer team had just lost the final to Don Barkham from America in 79. and this was 1980. He was going back to, hopefully go back to defend his title. And I've got a couple of lads from Edinburgh area. We knock out the runner-up from the year before. And my younger brother was with me. We were, 16. And we probably had our chances to win that junior title, but even at that age, we were having fun. Uh-huh. Andrew McQueen at the time just lost the final the year before. We were looking up to him, and all of a sudden we were in a position where we could have, I mean, we were two up and lost a three in the last end. But we weren't that disappointed at the time, but that was the first time I kind of realised, wait a minute, we can compete. I played in the open schools in those days, because they were from different, you could play from different schools. Uh-huh. And there was at that time 32 teams played in sections of four. It was, and we won it a couple of times, and that was really the start of it, that you knew you could do well. And then we skipped from one junior team to another junior team. It wasn't till my final year that we ended up playing with Dave Smith, because our birthdays were, we both made another year by 12 and 13 days.
Right.
And we got together with, I think it was his brother Pete and Peter Thompson from round about the Kirkcaldy area, and we went on and won the Scottish Juniors, and we lost the semi-final of the World Juniors to Christian Sager, who we still see on a regular basis, who does all the stats for the World Championships.
Yeah, so I was familiar with that name, but you go back to the other name you mentioned there, is the Smith family. David's a name that's got lots of connections with your career for, what, the next 20 years from what we're talking about there with the Scottish Junior days, isn't it?
25 years, maybe. Dave and myself were friends for a long time through curling, and obviously the juniors, and then we moved into seniors, and we went straight from juniors, and then Dave started skipping the following year in the men's, and we ended up winning the Scottish Championship with Mike Hay and Peter Smith. So it was probably four of them, at that age, four of the most talented curlers about. Went to the World Seniors, and for the first time for me, and we ended up winning 10 straight and lost the final. But we were kids, we were obviously disappointed, and uh-huh. I think with what's happened in, since then, we've been teammates and rivals for the last 40 years, maybe.
So we were talking off audio earlier about how important rivalries are to the growth and the enjoyment and the kind of public picture of sport. And it's something we've talked about in-house at Scottish Curling, about how the game has got one of the great rivalries at the moment with Team Mowat and White. So if we skip forward to current day, obviously young Hamilton is with Team Mowat. How important do you think it is to have big rivalries like that in the game?
I think it if you've got rivalries, they kind of gear teams to go that little bit further. If you're sitting there on your top and there's nobody challenging you, you get sort of complacent and things like that. But with Team White pushing Team Mowat on at the moment, it's fantastic to see how far they can actually go.
Yeah.
But Team White are a fantastic team as well. They, right from lead, second, third, they're a good, solid team.
Grand. We agree. But we'll talk about that maybe a bit later. If we skip back to the 80s, for many reasons. We haven't found any pictures of you with any dodgy clothing on yet, but I mean,
they are.
We might have to make some phone calls to see what we can get, but Scottish men's champion in 86, 87 and 88. That's quite the hat trick. And you weren't the skipper of that team though, were you? You were playing further up the rank.
No, I was playing number three for David. Playing number three for David in 86, and I've already sort of said that we got to the World Final that year. Uh-huh. And the following year, it ended up Dave getting out. Mike left and Dave, we kind of separated a little bit. We get knocked out in the first round. Back in those days, you could go back in the second round. So, and I never played in the districts. Dave did, but and then come the finals, I got a phone call from Grant McPherson, and I've known Grant, and we socialised a bit, and he says, "Look, can you play in the Scottish finals?" I said, "I would." So Billy Andrews couldn't play for work reasons and everything else, and said, "Well, come up and play." And the team was Bobby Wilson and Richard Harding,
right?
So we kind of knew, everybody knew each other, and went up. And Grant McPherson played fantastic at Kirkcaldy on very difficult ice, and you know, we had funny sort of times, and we enjoyed it. Everything was going well for us, and I always remember the semi, I was at the final, I think, first end. Grant's going to hit one in the nose and just for hit it out, and that was a blank end probably. And we burnt the stone and we lost the two in the first end. We got uh-oh. and it was against the Drybra team, who at that time were there and thereabouts. Uh-huh. And I kind of said, right, stay calm. And we did, and we ended up winning that final. So that was 87. 88, we get back together. Mike came back from his trip, and we got back together. And we beat Grant McPherson in the final, I think, that the fall of 88. And that year also went to the Olympics as a demonstration sport in Calgary in 1988. And we went there, and things just weren't going our way. Because tactically we were a big hitting team from 86, which we got a silver medal, and that's the first Scotland had won for 10 years plus. So Dave went with the idea that we're just going to play the same set of tactics, but curling's moved on a little bit, and for us we had to actually play a bit more aggressive. And as I said before, four tally curlers, but Dave never used them, so... that was 88. Went to Calgary, and we came back from there, and we had a meeting. And well, if you're not changing, I always just said, if you're not changing your tactics, then I'm not going to the World Championships. And basically, that's what happened. So I didn't go to Lausanne that year, but then the boys went there. I think they got I think they got silver. I think.
So,
how difficult a conversation is that to have with not just a teammate but a friend?
I didn't hold any any grudges or anything against it, because it was a decision on tactically wise. I personally wanted to play a more aggressive curling. I wanted to play some. I thought we were talented enough to take on people playing aggressive curling or more attractive curling, whereas sitting just hitting after hitting is just, it was getting boring, to be perfectly honest. So we never fell out over it. I said, "Now, good luck," and we parted our ways at that point. And then we played together since. Dave and me went to the Europeans in 2010. That was our swan song. We're a wee bit older then.
So there's a gap there when you look at those periods of, you won three in a row at the Scottish. There's a four-year gap, and then you're now a skip, and you win another four Scottish titles. So it sounds like it's fairly obvious to me, but you know, the reason we're asking this is we want to know your take on it. When you left that team after the 88 event, you weren't the skip, but you return at some point as the skip, and you go on to great success, you know, and everybody knows what comes next. When did you think, right, the next team that I'm in is going to be mine, it's going to have my name on it, and we're going to... we're going to do the sport in the way that we think is key, that's entertaining, that's more attractive?
It was basically organised that summer. We after 88, the first, so that was a kind of my job that year was to get to the Scottish finals the following year, get in the top six for a chance at the Europeans, and bring in a new team, and basically that's what I managed to finish in the top six in the Scottish, went to Europeans in 89, or the qualifiers, won the qualifiers and went and won the Europeans in 89. So it looks as if there was a year, but really it went from 88 straight on to 89, and then we lost a couple of Scottish finals, and I think 89 or 1990 definitely, and lost the final to Dave in 91, and then Dave went on and won the World Championships in 91, and then 92 we won the Scottish Championships, and we lost the final to Marcus Egler from Switzerland, who played out, the whole team played fantastic that day, and right from the first end where we were lying to, he picks a double, long double, and back in those days it was a little bit sort of harder to get back in the game, but no, we had a fantastic run, and then 94, 95, 96 we won European Championships. We didn't win the Scottish in those years, but we won the qualifiers for the Europeans. So consistency was the name of the game.
So you've, I mean, three Scottish titles in a row, then three Europeans in a row. Consistency is the thing that every athlete looks for when they're at that top level. So you've managed to do it on, you know, more than two occasions throughout your career. When you flip forward now and you see the way that the game is at the moment, you know, are you happy that it's one of those old things that consistency, no matter what level you're at, it's the thing that you've got to chase? Don't chase the title, chase the consistency.
No, but growing up, we had to chase the title. Because for me, maybe not for a lot of other colours, but for me, the way I looked at it and the way some of the other ones, it was a stepping stone. A Scottish Championship or a European qualifier was a stepping stone to the next level where you wanted to be. I mean, no disrespect to some of the Scottish champions, I think Scottish Championships is what their pinnacle was, what they wanted to do. They didn't push and didn't think they could go much further. I think myself and the teams that I had, it was a stepping stone to get where we wanted to be. But when you had a big rivalry, or two or three big rivals, because there was Dave Smith, Gordon Muirhead, Colin Hamilton, people like that, you know, they were in between Dave and myself winning, these boys were winning and getting to world finals. It was, the rivalry is a, you need that, and consistency. I've always said, we've tried sports psychologists, but it wasn't working for me. But the way I looked at the tennis players and I said, look, the top tennis players don't have peaks and troughs. They just stay at the high level all the way through. They might lose, but their peak is very, very high. And I always felt that if you can do that at curling, you're going to win more than you lose.
You talk about that pinnacle. What is it that feels different about going from a Scottish to a Europeans, a Worlds, an Olympics? What is it? Because, you know, as just normal guys, we see these tournaments and they're massive. But as an athlete, what is it that feels different about getting to these points? And
I think one of the big things is putting on your national jersey. Or, for instance, representing Scotland's a fantastic honour. And it gives you that wee bit of pride. You want to sort of, it spurs you on a little bit. Putting on sort of the Union Jack as well. I mean, it does, it inspires you. Whether it works for you or not, it's a different thing. But certainly every time you put on the Scottish top, you want to go out there and you want to sort of prove to everybody even at home that you're capable and you should be there at that level.
So if we can return to the Olympics as a whole, you mentioned that slightly sobering experience the first time where it was 0-7.
0-7, yes.
0-7. And then you go back in 92. It's yourself, Norman Brown, Gordon Muirhead, Roger McIntyre, and Bob Kelly as the five. And it's still a demonstration sport, which sounds a bit, it sounds like it's always a strange label to give something that's at the Olympics.
And there's medals for it. But in Arborville in 92, it was a totally different experience altogether. We were stuck up in a wee mountain village. And unfortunately, the day we arrived, we asked some of the other teams had been there beforehand and they'd practiced, and they said, oh, the ice is great and everything. We got up the next morning and the plant had froze. And it was just surreal, the whole thing. And It was one of these things where you've been told the ice is good, you get up the next morning, then the big decisions are made. Are we going to stay here and play on two sheets of ice, play all the games on two sheets of ice, basically around the clock type, or are we going to move to Morzine, where we've got a full kind of arena? And we ended up, everybody stayed, and we played on two sheets of ice that were, some one was just basically pure frost, and the other one was, you wouldn't, people nowadays, it wouldn't be acceptable. Uh-huh. But that's what we had. It was a demonstration sport, and we just had to go along with it. And, you know, you've got the hierarchy coming in to watch it and things like that, and you're trying to do, I mean, it was basically a showcase. Uh-huh. But it was a different thing altogether. But a fantastic venue, but unfortunately the ice froze, and it just...
If you go back to that famous word you mentioned just a few minutes ago, but consistency, how on earth do you get consistency when the conditions are so variable from game to game?
It's hard to even, for curlers nowadays, to even think about what it was like. Uh-huh. I mean, over the years, we played in some horrendous ice. I mean, some of it was terrible compared to what these boys now are playing on, stuff that dreams are made of.
Uh-huh.
And they're, not just that, they're practicing on that ice.
Yeah.
You know, I'll come back to that one then next time when you talk about the seniors.
So that's Albertville. You don't go to the next Olympics, which is the Nagano event in 1998. Mm-hmm. And I think Peter wants to ask you a couple of things about the qualification process.
You came into that qualifiers, or whatever you want to call it, really hot, and you were playing well. I'm interested how you felt about that tournament of four teams, round robin. How did you feel as a team going into that? And how do you feel making it all the way and losing that single match and that deciding everything?
We went into it, we thought, well, we're playing well, we had a good chance. At that time we were sort of not breaking records, but we were winning games that were in long stretches, maybe 20, 30 games at a time without losing. We actually went into that one there, and we lost the last, if we'd won the last round robin game, there wouldn't have been a playoff, I don't think. Our record, if you went back and looked at, if it was points won for this, that, and the next thing, then there wouldn't have been a competition, but that was the rules, and you had to abide by them. And unfortunately, the one-off game, the driver of the team beat us, and that was probably the first time they'd beat us in a semi-final or a final over 10 years, maybe. So it was one of these things. And then I went down to London and sat in a studio and had to watch it.
Were you doing commentary?
I was doing commentary for BBC in the middle of the night. Never again.
Well...
I don't want to rub it in further, but there is a point to this.
I told you nothing was off the table.
It was described, so I was reading an old Scottish curling magazine, and it's described by Leslie Ingham Brown as your team's worst game of the season, that final. How do you go from that, and the disappointment from that, and sitting in the studio in London, to world champion within the year?
Yeah, it's a bit surreal at times. Obviously, going down to London, if you're going to commentate, you want to be actually in the arena, you want to be live. Sitting in a studio watching, it just wasn't... I didn't enjoy it, to be perfectly honest. And then after that, we sort of... A few of the boys had said they were finished, that was enough for them. I can remember a conversation with Norman Brown, who was my third player at the time, playing a game of golf, going down the 13th at Dunsky. And he said that was him, he was for packing it in, and he let the youngsters get on with it. And I was, wait till the youngsters can beat you. I still had that, you know, I still wanted to win things, and at that time I wasn't sure. And then the phone call came in not long after that from Warwick Smith, which was a bit of a surprise. I got on well with Warwick and everybody else, and he sort of asked me if I wanted to come and play third. And I thought I'd be there. I thought, well, who else have we got? And Pete Loudon, who played with us as well. So Pete was coming in to play. I said, need a second player. So we discussed it and we came up with the name Ewan McDonald. So and that's how the team got together. And we went to qualify. We played a couple of competitions in Canada, which we went over and we had a lot of fun. and it really was. I mean, it was a lot of that was team building, I would say.
Uh-huh.
You know, we flying out to play in the Wilton Beauchamp. I can tell this story, I think. It's not too bad. and we're flying out first thing in the morning from Glasgow or Edinburgh, and we get down to London. We've got a couple of hours to burn. Transatlantic flight. So, Wellspoons. So in we go, or the pub, whatever. I think it was Wellspoons, I'm not sure. Went in there, had a couple of drinks, and right, what time are we flying? Warwick says, it's 11:15 we're flying. So come just before quarter to, I said, right, come on boys, we've got to go. I went outside and I looked up at the board. Warwick, there's no flights to Ottawa here. Oh no, that can't be, I've got the tickets. So Warwick looks at the tickets. 10:45. So I'm looking at that and go, oh no. Right, and I just said, Warwick, there's the tickets, go and get it sorted. So this is London, you know. Warwick comes back, big smile on his face. He's got this sorted. We're flying to Toronto, which is not that far in the big picture. So when the flight leaves at, say, 2:30, and we all looked at each other. Back in. So we went back into the pub straight away and we're going, this is team building, you see. You know, and we're going to play in a big competition, and next thing we said, right, come on boys, we've got to go. So I just gave all the tickets out. I said, so just walk in, we'll go on the plane. We had back in those days you could have a pickle and sit in there. And we went. And I looked back, I said, here's Warwick trying to get an upgrade. Going, oh, boys. So, you know, you think, oh, wow. So, onto the plane, and it was the lead sitting one side, I'm sitting the other side, Ewan's in the middle, and Warwick's in the middle. And up comes the second in charge of the plane, the second pilot, whatever his name was. And he goes, well, unfortunately, gentlemen, we will not be serving you any alcohol on this flight. And we'd ask you to refrain from your duty free. And I think the nods were just, the heads were nodding. So the boys were sort of sleeping within sort of 15, 20 minutes. That was them out. Never seen a plane take off. Girl came up, I had a couple of drinks and that was fine. We get to Toronto and we're putting the stack in Toronto. We're flying around and on comes the pilot. And the pilot goes, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to divert to Ottawa. And all you seen was the three guys jumping up and down, yes! And everybody else in the plane, they're going to look at what's going on. So we eventually got to Ottawa just a couple of hours late, without any luggage because it went to Toronto. But that was the team building that we had at the time, and it was, you know, it's a funny enough story.
So what you're saying is Warwick Smith, good colour, awful travel agent. Is that what I'm saying?
Terrible travel agent. We did okay. I think we got to the quarterfinals of the tournament, and we had a lot of fun that time. And that was probably the team building that we started. So, and then after that, we came home. We had to go to the qualifiers in Ayr. And at that time, we'd lost a couple of games, and Mike, who was the coach at the time, Mike said, "Hey, look, we need to have a word here." He says, "Army, you're going to have to skip," and I'm going, no. So what happened was I went on and I was skipping my first game, and I think it's first, second day, and I had a shot for five and I missed it. And I'm going, oh boys, what's going on here? And then after that, we basically never lost, hardly lost a game, and we qualified and went to the Scottish finals and then went to the Worlds. So it was great.
Do you think part of you had a point to prove, if anything, to yourself?
At that point, I suppose, you know, I'd only sort of come back at, I came back in skipping halfway through the season. I had to make sure that everybody was happy with that and that was fine. And I suppose I did have a point to prove. I'd played a lot of big shots, and which were, I mean, they're all commentated on and they were seen on TV and things like that, but it was actually winning the right way. I'd lost two world finals before we went to 99. And I suppose I felt I'd tried to win one. We'd sort of lost to the Canadians, which was, they were the most aggressive curling team there. Went in 99 and I said, well, I'm going to give it my big, you know, I'm not going to, for the lack of effort, I'm going to try and win it. So, but we went through the week, we had a great time, and it came to a couple, there was a couple of wee instances that happened and it sort of seemed to change things around. There's always moments in a tournament that seem to sort of change, and one of them was against Sweden when we were, I think we were needing a two to get the peel, to get the extra end it was, I think, or 10th end, and I tried a freeze in my first and it didn't come off right, and I remember Warwick sort of turning around, Warwick saying, well, I hope he sort of plays wide and jams it or something like that. I says, that's the only thing we've got. I says, well, I hope he spills the whole lot out and I'll split this one out from here. And Warwick's going, you can't split that out. You can't split that into the house, from not from out there. I says, well, I think that's the best chance we've got. So he peeled everyone out of the house and Swede was very happy, jumping up and down, and thought he'd won the game. And I sat down and I sort of split this one from quite well out of the house, both hanging in by about an inch on either side. I think it was kind of, Swede was kind of deflated after that. And that was the start. We never lost another game after that. But I think we had conversations that there was, in the middle of the ice, that there was nowhere to hide. You know, you've got 4,000 or 5,000 people watching you and you've got to perform. And after that moment, the boys just went out and played absolutely unbelievable curling.
So it's in St John, New Brunswick, 99. We talked just off audio before we started recording about semi-finals and how important they are. 6-4 against the USA in the semi-final. Was that a cagey match, or was that something you always felt confident in?
I think we always had control of the match.
Uh-huh.
It was against one of our old sort of good friends in Don Barkham,
uh-huh,
who I mentioned played against Andrew McQueeston in the,
yeah.
So he was up against us, and I mean, we played really well in that game, and we always had control. But it's always nice to get off the ice after winning a semi final. You know that you're going into the final, as it turned out, a couple of days' time, because that was the Friday night.
Aye.
So that was good.
2 days break. How do you deal with that? Going from semi final, you're comfortable and knowing there's a final coming. How do you deal with that? 2 days.
Tell the truth.
No, I told you nothing's off the table. Well, I mean, we kind of, just after the semi-final, after the sort of media was done and everyone, boys are saying, right, what, it was fairly late at night, what are we going to do? I said, well, come on, we'll go to the Hog Line Inn, which was like, Hog Line Inn was like a
fan zone type
fan
thing.
Zone type thing where you could, you know, meet other people and meet teams and all that kind of stuff. And so, and St John was, most of it was all underneath because it gets really, really bitterly cold during the winter, and most of the sort of passageways are underneath the city. So we're down there and we're walking along and some of the boys went away ahead in front of us and they came back, oh, queues, and no way we're getting in. So I'm sort of talking to people behind, is that as per usual? So I get up to the front and the guy goes, "Hi Hammy, how you doing? Come on in." Because we'd been in a couple of times before and we had a couple of beers and that. So we get in there and we just said, "Boys, enjoy yourself. We're not on until Sunday night. A lot of time to burn." So we're having conversations and the Canadian sort of coach came up to me and we're chatting away. We knew each other, Jim Waite, who was the sort of mentor of the team at that time. And we're cracking away and Jim goes, "What are you going to do on Sunday? What's your plans on Sunday?" "I'm going to hear him and scare him." And he goes, "What does that mean?" I says, "You'll see on Sunday." So we had a few beers that night and then we had the whole day. We got some practice ice and we get to pick stones and we, you know, different things. Just trying to keep ourselves busy. And then you've got the whole day Sunday to sort of burn as well.
Yeah.
But at that time, I think the ladies were on, so you could go and, not that we, I don't think we did, but it was just a case of burning time. And it's, back in those days, you didn't have such as mobile phones that you could play games or the TV and all that kind of stuff. So, but we just burned time and generally speaking, we could get some sleep.
Uh-huh.
I mean, believe it or not, athletes are quite good. Well, not that I'm an athlete, but they're usually pretty good at finding a few hours nip, sort of kip here, there and everywhere. So, and that's basically what we did. But it was a long time because I think it was because it was right in the east. They didn't start until maybe 7 o'clock at night or something, because it was going out to the west coast as well. So by the time you finished, it was maybe 10 o'clock at night, or 11. That'd be 10 o'clock at night.
So it's Sunday. It's gold medal match day, and this is one of on our Scottish Curling social media. We shared this a couple of times. This match is one of our most popular feeds. Every time we share it is the match, and it's against a guy whose name I keep pronouncing incorrectly, so educate us, Hammy. Who was the skip of the opposing Canadian team?
Jeff Stone.
I keep on saying Stockton.
Stockton.
So that's a match that goes to an extra end, but you were up in the final in the 10th end and concede a 2. What's now, we've seen you in action at the seniors with some of your teammates, so what's going through your mind? And what are you saying to the lads? Have you conceded a 2? Was it something that you felt was a big error, or was it something that was just that was going to happen?
Well, earlier on in the game, I actually missed a shot. I mean, it's hard for me to say because I missed a draw for a 2 earlier on, or maybe it might be a 2 or 3 earlier on. So it's hard for me to say too much. You know, we actually did pretty well. We kept the end pretty well open. I think we had a chance to finish it off earlier on, and Warwick nicked one and it came in. With my 2, there was a possible doubles on, but it was very close to, if you get too close to the guard, you catch the guard, you lose the game.
Yeah.
So always early on the other side, I missed them both probably by millimetres. So we managed to just lose a 2 down the extra end, and the boys played a great end.
Are you not feeling nervous at that point, or have you just locked out by getting to that stage?
The funny thing is, I don't think nerves never really came into it when it was like a polytunnel. You did hear certain things coming out with the crowd. You would hear the sort of Scottish shouts and things like that, but generally speaking, you were zoned in on a polytunnel 15 feet wide and like 150 feet long, so you could see distractions and things like that, but it was never really in your head. And I always said, give me the 4 foot to win. I don't think, and that was maybe the first time in 25 years anybody had to do it. And nowadays it's common. It's just that's the way you win a world championship, so or win big games nowadays is drawing the 4 foot. But I had conversations with an old champion, it was Al Hackner from Canada, who won in 82 and the Kelvin Hall in 85. And we got to know each other over the years. I mean, I played him as a teenager in 82 and beat them, and that, and you know, conversations afterwards over a few beers and things like that, was, it was a case of, like, you can hit really well, but you have to learn to draw the forefoot to win the games. And that was stuck in my head, and when I sat down to play it, it was, you know, the boys asked for, when the split timings which we used at that time were, they asked for 3:05 or something, and I think I threw 3:05, I think, some very, very close. We sort of swept it hard, and then we kind of stood back off it, and then, you know, most of the pictures show that it just got into the front, but actually went right on at the bottom. So it was a sort of my dream coming through. As a youngster, we didn't have the Olympics or anything like that, we just did the World Championships. Mm-hmm. And the World Championships was something that we, so I managed to achieve what I wanted to do. So it was great.
So it's one of the earliest Cullen moments I remember, the 99 win. Does it change you when you win a World Championship, either as an athlete or as a human being?
I don't think it's... the people of Stranraer certainly didn't let me change, that's for sure. I think I still, in the pub and things like that, I still got what's Cullen? What are you talking about? You know, it was a lot of it was in jest. Now, a lot of these boys and that do watch, and they watch Young Hammy quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
But back in those days, you didn't get that much on TV. But certainly the people of Stranraer are absolutely fantastic, down to earth, and you walk up the street, well done, Hammy, and that was basically it, all the, you know, that kind of stuff. And it is it's a fairly big, and it still is a big curling area.
Uh-huh.
And was that a quiet night after you won that?
No, none of the nights were very quiet. We had a reputation to keep up. No, but we had a good night that night, and then unfortunately we were back on the plane at, I think, 5 o'clock in the morning, back to Toronto, and then we had a full day's leave.
Was this arranged by Warwick Smith, or did you get somebody else in charge of it?
Still be there if it was arranged by Warwick Smith.
No, it was just, there's stories there that just shouldn't be told, so.
Right, okay.
We were in the place beforehand, and we back into the place 13 days later, I think it was, so, and the boys had good conversations, and it was, you know, a 5 or 6 hour layover in Toronto, and then fly home, and we got upgraded on the way home, which was, back in those days, that was pretty good, so, no, and the people of Scotland turned up, and things like that, nice rinks and that, was great, but, you know, I was the third skip to win.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Chuck Hay was a mentor to most of the youngsters, so then Chuck, and then Dave won in 91, and then 99, and then followed on by the ones that have come since. Basically, once we kind of finished up, and Dave Murdoch was about, and he did really well, and Ewan McDonald went to play with, so he was with us in 99. So
yeah, so after 99. Did you feel there was a target on your back, either domestically or internationally, as the team to beat, as the skip to beat?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no doubt about it. But I think in some ways complacency comes into it.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly think we wanted to represent Scotland in 2000 at the Brayhead Centre, and unfortunately that didn't happen. But I think we were complacent. We didn't put the hard work in, and I think that's what caught us out.
So the same four in 99 stays together throughout the next years leading up to the O2 Olympics, is that right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'd like to talk about Salt Lake City in 2002 as well, because it was a significant moment for curling, for the profile of curling, and obviously for yourself, for a few reasons. So the same four lads, and you're going into these Olympics as the favourite, aren't you?
I don't think we were going in as favourite. I think the Canadians and that were always, they were the sort of favourites that year. I think, definitely the favourites, the Canadians. The Canadians basically were favourites every time you went, but we came in with a fairly good record, and we'd won a few competitions and done all right, but When we got there, the ice was really, really fast, straightish. I never caught it at all. So, you know, there was discussions, and I went down and played down, and Warwick came on. But, you know, it was tough for everybody. It wasn't the easiest time in the world.
What are your memories? I'm interested to go back a step and get into an Olympics, and it's your first, you know. I don't want to say proper Olympics,
but
there's a medal on the line.
Yeah. It was the first proper Olympics.
How is that? How different is that? What were your emotions going into that? Was it excitement? Are there nerves for the first time?
I'm not going to say there was nerves, but it was certainly different. The lead up to, I mean, when you go to a World Championships in your own sport, then you know the parameters, you know what's there. When you go to the Olympics for the first time, you've got everything to deal with. And that's one of the things that was different, where security wise and everything, you know, you had to go through finding different places. Salt Lake City was a difficult place in itself, or Ogden, where we were. It was a sort of back of beyond in a way, so it was different. It wasn't, and it's not curling people. You know, even the fans, most of the fans that are there are just, they go to the Olympics.
Aye.
And they'll take any tickets for any sport, which is a little bit different. But no, that was probably, for me, one of the toughest sort of times that in curling went through, was to go there and, you know, first Olympics, thinking, well, hopefully we'll come back with something, but we never came back winning at all. It was just for me personally, it was a bad experience.
Was it you that removed yourself from that experience then for the team?
No, I think it was at the time a team thing, and it didn't. I was probably at the time I was hoping for the back end of the team.
Uh-huh.
But as it turned out, you know, they thought it was better to bring somebody else in, so that's fine. You've got to accept this in a team event. You know, I expect a higher set of standards of myself, but as I said, the icing was very fast and it was pretty straight. It was tough to deal with. It wasn't just me that had the problem with it.
Uh-huh.
And nowadays, you know, with different sort of sweeping and all that, makes a big difference. But back in those days, it was a difficult position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And but you live with it and go on with it, and you just keep kicking on.
So did it affect your love or your involvement in the game at all, that O2 experience? Did you say, I'm going to take some time away from the sport in general?
Not really, no, because I played in a couple of Scottish Championships after that.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, still, in fact, I think I lost a couple of finals and semi-finals even after that, and then joined up again with my old rival Dave Smith, and we played one season together, just as a kind of swan song, I think, more than anything else.
Uh-huh.
And we qualified for European Championships in 2010, which we were probably the oldest boys there. We were, at that time, 44, 45.
Uh-huh.
And we had a couple of younger boys, like Ross Patterson was playing second.
Uh-huh.
And Ross, he's moved on from that as well.
He's now coaching,
yep.
Yeah.
You know, and when you look at it that way, I mean, going to the European Championships was quite fun, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, you went as a 5-time winner, you had nothing to prove.
Nothing to prove, and Dave had won it a couple of times as well. And there was one game we played against Nicholas Eden.
Uh-huh.
In his early days, and the team was lead, I think it was Ross Patterson. Second was David Murdoch, third was David Smith, and I was the skip. So you had the three last World Championship skips all playing together against so-called GOAT, as in, uh-huh, Nicholas Eden. So that was fun. I mean, I think at that time we were probably just close to the end of it.
Uh-huh. But it's never really the end, is it? Because
no, it's not.
You have a legacy, and your son. And you've gone from obviously a competitor at the highest level in your own curling life to now you've done a bit of media. You've obviously travelled around, you've written articles for various sites and various papers, and you obviously wrote a book called Curling Tactics by Hammy McMillan, which I've read. Interested to know, you've talked quite a bit about your own game there, about whether it was hitting, about whether it was an attractive style of curling the right way. How do you view what the lads do, and in particular on the men's side, because that's where most of your experience obviously is. But there's a quote here that's attributed to you from the Curling News that says, "These curlers are so confident nowadays and think they can do anything. They're so gung-ho, it's like they never worry about the consequences." That sounds like it's also about you as well.
I think when we were younger, I mean, if it was chances of playing shorts, then yeah, a lot of times I would go for them.
Uh-huh.
But you didn't see them that often. Nowadays, the way the boys play, it's fantastic to watch. You know, it's exciting. And when that team is on form, they'll play every shot in the book. And it's not just Bruce that plays them. Grant Hardy was without a doubt, he was the MVP of the World Championships this year. He was just awesome. And then Bobby had a great World Championships, and Hamilton, kind of, I'm not saying that he's, but he was just as usual. When I say that, I mean, he's in the 90% bracket, and he set himself a standard, you know. And 8 years ago, the question was, well, did they go out, Grant and him go out himself, or did they join up with such and such? And I says, well, if you're going to join up, whatever position you're in, make sure you're the best in the world at it. And I think over the last 8 years, he's proven that he is up in the top 1, 2, 3 in the world at it.
When you watch them, do you ever think or wish that this was your generation? Because you would have thrived in this.
Yeah, I think the shorts that you can play and you're allowed to play nowadays, yeah, I would have probably thrived on it. I'd have loved the opportunity to do it, but they now have the knowledge of what the brushing does in the game. They have the ice conditions, which are absolutely fantastic. I mean, the boys now practice on ice that we could only dream of back in the day. But technology has taken over a little bit, and with experience and everyone else, if you could look back, there was one wee man, an eccentric wee man called Shorty Jenkins. Now, Shorty Jenkins, I got to know Shorty really well, basically because I was a smoker. And the only place you could smoke in these big arenas was in the Iceman's shack. See, this is it sounds really strange, but you know, and I got really friendly with Paul Troelsen from Norway because we were both smokers, and this is the only place you could smoke. But you also find out more about the game and about the ice from this wee man, because he was. He came in and he was sort of the first person to rub the stones. And now, halfway through championships, they now rub the stones. But he was doing that 20 years before anybody else was doing it. And he had so many different heads, and, you know, he'd be sitting in there, I mean, in some of the competitions, and they would come in with this ice just packed in, stick it in a microwave, melt the ice down so they could see how much ice they actually took off that sheet. And he'd be able to tell you, that'll be swinging in the sixth end. That'll maybe swing another foot or two. And, you know, you got to know the knowledge. And that was just because I was a smoker. But I also, you know, there was an ice rink at home that was a little bit different than most. the competition now, and it'd be great to play. I get to play it in the seniors just a little bit. And you get to see shorts that were there. The odd time, now they're there a lot of the time, but we don't have the power in the seniors like what these boys have. They're athletes. I was never an athlete.
Well, there's probably a few folk that would disagree with that. But we've just had the Olympic team announcements for Milan Cortina 2026. and your son's going to be an Olympian again. How does that make you feel?
Not just my son, I'm proud of the whole team. My nephew Grant's in there. You know, and it's they now have a chance to go and do one better than what they did the last time. They're working hard all the time. I mean, I couldn't put in the time. You know, I took 2 or 3 months off once before I went to the Olympics, and I said I would never do it again, you know, because I was bored. I couldn't go, I couldn't practice all the time. I couldn't, we never thought about going to a gym or anything like that. But these boys are back into, I think, in a couple of weeks' time, and so that's the middle of July.
Yeah.
And they're back into, you know, back into hard training. You know, and the harder training they do, the easier the games will be. But they certainly, you know, they know what they want. You know, they know what they want, and they know how to go and get it. It just depends on what happens. 4 years ago, they got off to a slow start in the final. First couple of ends, slow start, and they nearly got it back. If they had another couple of ends, the chances are they probably would have got it back. A lot of teams, even 4 years, it's going to be similar. So it's they have I'm not saying they have a fear factor, but they certainly have a lot of the team's number, and they've just got to go out there, and they know if they play to their best ability, they can win, and that's what they have to do.
How do you find it watching your son play in these kind of events? Is it easier to be playing yourself?
Very much so. I'm very fortunate that when I get to go and watch in the big competitions, you know, I can sneak a press pass and things like that, and I can go and sit by myself, usually away out of the way, and I can, even if I'm on the sidelines, I can still tell by the body language of the boys and the shouts that the boys make whereabouts or how good it's going to be and things like that. And believe it or not, I still sit up there and do interval timings. And these interval timings, they're never far away. You know, when Bruce plays his last shot to win the World Championships, as soon as he lets it go, I'm sort of looking at, I see the boys' sort of motions and everyone else, I says, yeah, he's good. You know, it could pick up, but the boys are keeping it clean, and you know, you're still nervous, but you know. The first time I ever watched the boys play live together, 7 or 8 years, about 8 years ago now, the first Scottish Championship, I can remember, so I put a quote on Facebook at the time, and I said, look, I've played with some of the best teams in the world, I've played against the best teams in the world, and this team here is better than all of them, and that was when they just first got together. You could see that they had so much more to give playing that there, and they were the communication and the team. They still have it. There'll still be sort of niggly wee bits that they've got to sort out, and they'll probably still be sorting them out in next year and things like that, but they know what they have to work on. They're a fantastic team to watch. And it's, you know, but they're also, they're a team that they're approachable. Where, you know, in a lot of sports you get that the top stars are not approachable. Uh-huh. And these boys are approachable, and they'll basically do anything that they're asked. If they're asked to go to schools and things like that, they'll go and do it. They'll promote the game to the best of their best of ability.
Yeah, we've experienced that, so yeah, for sure. That's exactly what they're like. They're amongst the humblest great athletes that have ever played any sport, really. So we've got a few little rapid fire questions to finish on, right? So we're just looking for that instinctive answer that you've got. So start with an easy one. Stone colour, red or yellow?
Always go light.
Toughest opponent you faced?
Over the years, I would say obviously a lot of the Canadian teams, but at home, it was always David Smith was always the biggest rival.
Funniest teammate and why? You can't even vote for yourself.
I'm not saying I'm funny, no. That's a strange one. Oh, well, not Warwick.
Warwick
was
the
always
the travel agent.
The travel agent, yeah. He was always up for it.
So this might be an easy one. A moment you would relive again if you could.
I suppose winning the World Championships, winning the Europeans in the same year. In the short, we played an angled race to win it. And there's these funny stories there because, you know, I played an angled race to win the Europeans in Chamonix in 99. And one of the boys missed a shot or just skinned a shot. And it went to the side, me being me, I'm going, raging. Warwick comes down and he says, I just nicked it there and that's for you to angle in at the end. You know, and I'm going, oh man, I've got to shake my head again. And it just turns out that's exactly what I had to do. But he says, oh, I just nicked it across there so you could angle it in.
And lastly, with one iron, perhaps the Grand Slam, because this is something that comes up there quite a bit. Blank ends, yes or no?
When you say blank ends, it depends on the circumstances. You know, if you fight hard the whole game and then you're needing a blank end in the ninth, then there's no reason why you shouldn't be able. We've had it in the rules where if you blank one, then the hammer changes.
Yeah.
Or things like that. You know, nowadays, most of these teams will play the right way. You know, you get the odd team that sort of plays a bit negatively, but most of the teams will play the right way. And I don't see any reason why if a blank end, a lot of these blank ends that you see in curling nowadays, they don't start off as blank ends. They start off with maybe 3 or 4 or 5 stones in the house, and about 3 or 4 stones later, oh, where have they gone? Mm-hmm. And then this is what happens. So I would say you can blank ends, but not at the start of the games and things like that. You play the game. If you're up in the game, then you should be able to peel it, because it's tough shots to make.
So Hammy, how would you, looking back at your career, what would you say to the younger version of yourself? How it's going to go, how curling is going to treat you, what would you say to that version of yourself?
I'd find it hard to change too much. I mean, if you moved everything forward sort of 35, 40 years, then you'd probably be, you know, you need to go to the gym, you need to work hard to get where you were. You might have won more, but would have had much fun. Debatable.
So, Hammy McMillan, Olympian, world champion, dad, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A huge thanks to Hammy McMillan Sr. for being our second guest and for his fantastic hospitality at the Craig and Elder Hotel. We hope you're enjoying the Scottish Curling Podcast, and if you are, please share it with your friends, family and fellow curlers. And a wee review wherever you get your podcasts would be great too. We'll be back next week, but from Vincent and myself,